Well, good morning. Wonderful to see a full audience today, as was mentioned in the announcements. If you are visiting with us, you are an honored guest. We're so appreciative of you being here. We're so glad to have you, and we encourage you, stick around for just a couple of minutes, and we encourage you to come to our potluck, enjoy some fellowship with us as we get the chance to meet with you and to enjoy spending time with you. As I mentioned in the first lesson, we're going through series of questions that have been submitted and answering some of the questions that the congregation has. And so this morning, we got the chance to talk a little bit about the idea of wisdom in sobriety, about the proper relationship between a Christian and alcohol. The second lesson is going to be a little bit different. So the first lesson is kind of a topical one. The second question that I want to address today is actually a textual one. And so I encourage you, both types are more than welcome. I appreciate topical questions, but if you have a question about a text, if there is a particular biblical passage that just really confuses you and you're not sure what's going on with that, you'd like us to spend some time with that, I encourage you, those are also more than welcome. And so today's question is actually going to come from 1 Samuel chapter 15. And so if you want to go ahead and turn there, we'll briefly start there and then go a few pages back. But the question is actually a fairly common one with people in dealing with the Old Testament, that there is a consistent topic that appears in the Old Testament in the idea of how Israel, as a nation, is given the task in various points in its story of destroying a people. And this is one of the questions that most often is asked and is most often used in particular to denigrate the character of God. How could a loving God order, and typically the term that's used is genocide. How could God order an entire people to be exterminated? And lots of different things have been offered in that discussion, and really that's a broader discussion than what we're going to particularly focus on today. But it's a good question. It does seem, particularly on a surface level value, it does seem incongruent when we look at the New Testament and Jesus tells us to love your enemies, and in the Old Testament those enemies are destroyed. There does seem to be some incongruency there. We might question, well, does this seem so different? Why does this seem so difficult to reconcile these things? And so these are good questions to ask, and these are good things to wrestle with. And so we might spend a little bit more time on that broader question. But the question that comes to us today is a particular one, and that's why in 1 Samuel 15, 1 through 2, is the people of Amalek ordered to be destroyed? So let's read what's going on here to set the context. In chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, it says, Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Now there's a couple of things to note as we begin this passage is that Samuel is telling Saul, we know at this point in the story, Saul has been made king by Samuel and by the Lord. And Samuel essentially says, Saul, there is unfinished business between this people group, Amalek, the Amalekites, and Israel. And there's a reference. He says, what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. So what is about to occur in 1 Samuel 15 is not something random. There's a reason for this. There's a rationale for what's going on here. And in particular, there's some past event that Samuel says, this past event is why we're about to do what we're going to do. So in order to answer this question, we have to go back to discover, first off, who are these people? Who are the Amalekites? And secondly, what did they do that the Lord, not Saul making up his mind, but the Lord has sent word to Saul through Samuel, it's time to bring justice to the Amalekites. So that's our first question. Why would God exterminate a people? And really, I think the other part of this question has to be, did God order the extermination of the people? We'll pick that topic up in just a second. But turn over, if you will, to Genesis chapter 36, verse 12 through 16. What we will find is pretty much, this isn't always the case, but it's almost always the case. Anytime you read of a group of people that is an enemy of Israel, whether it's in Judges, whether it's in 1 and 2 Samuel, Kings, any of those passages, almost every single one of those people has its origins in the Genesis story. Sometimes it's a really brief reference. Amalek is a really brief reference. But sometimes we get explanation of like the Moabites and the Ammonites. We're explained that they come from the relationship between Lot and his daughters. Babel is first set up as this archetypal evil city that's built by Nimrod. We get discussions of Cush and Assyria and all these different groups, Persia even, of where do these groups originate from. And so all of these groups are part of a very broad story. All of these groups are not just historical entities, but they're also being used as a part of the narrative of the Old Testament to illustrate something about Israel, and more importantly, to illustrate something about God. So with that in mind, let's look in Genesis chapter 36, and let's get introduced to the Amalekites. In verse 12, this is in a section talking about Esau, the brother of Jacob. It says in verse 9, now these are the records of the generation of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in the hill country of Seir. Now, the Edomites don't exist yet in the Genesis story, so this is reminding us that this is telling a story that's already happened to a generation that would be aware of, oh, the Edomites. We know them. They're neighbors. We know them. Okay, so this is where they come from. And so it says in verse 12 that Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. So Amalek is a grandson of Esau. Now, this might seem really random. This might seem like, okay, why do we want to start here? One of the reasons that Genesis gives all of these genealogies that we tend to kind of skip past because we're like, these don't really matter to us, it's all these dead people. This was really significant to Israelite readers. Genealogies were stories to the Israelites that they would be able to read these and be like, ah, we recognize these names. That explains where this people came from. Not only does it explain where they come from, it explains why there is antipathy, why there is aggression between us and between these people. The Edomites were one of Israel's most historical enemies. The Israelites and the Edomites were constantly fighting against each other. Very similar, we might note, to the story of how Jacob and Esau are constantly pitted against each other. So it comes as little surprise that a descendant of Esau, a grandson of Esau, Amalek, would also produce a people that were in conflict with Israel. And so we're already being prepped. Remember that the story of the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that's all one cohesive story. We're being prepared very early on in the story to be expecting people descended from Esau to act similar to how Esau and Jacob acted with one another. Now, this is a little bit more of a tenuous connection. We won't spend too much time on this. One of the things that a lot of recent studies have begun to unearth and started to make connections of is that a lot of the discussions of the conquest of Canaan are specifically going to be tied into this broader story that we see briefly referenced in Genesis chapter 6 with the giants. Now, these giants are called by a variety of different names, and we see the most famous one of these giants is David facing Goliath. Now, Goliath does not just pop up on the scene out of nowhere. And the Israelite readers who are reading about Goliath wouldn't be like, wow, it sure is weird that there's this massive guy on the Philistine side. What a genetic happenstance. They would immediately connect this to a broader story of how one of Israel's tasks was to destroy the giants. Because the giants were the product of this rebellion that we see in Genesis chapter 6, where the sons of God, these spiritual beings, came down, rebelled, and children, the Nephilim, are produced out of them. Those Nephilim are the giants. There's connections here, and I don't want to spend too much time getting into the nitty-gritty of these words. There is connectivity in Seir, this area that Esau is in, with those giant clans. And so, it is not a stretch for us to say that the rivalry between Amalek and between Israel is a part of this broader rivalry between God and these spiritual rebels. And part of Israel's task in the conquest is to destroy these spiritual rebels, particularly their physical offspring. So we're not going to spend too much time in that, but all of this is to paint the picture that there is a very large narrative going on here that the original readers of these texts would totally be in tune with. That would be, they would read these things and be like, oh yeah, of course, this is in reference to these things. Ah, yes, that name, the Anakim or the Rephaim or the Nephilim, ah, yes, that puts us back into that Genesis 6, that Deuteronomy 32 mindset. So with that in mind, let's go to the historical event in question. Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17, if you can remember the book of Exodus, puts us right after the title event of the Exodus. That in chapter 14, Israel has been led through the water. Chapter 15, we've got the song of victory. Chapter 16 is the provision of manna. It's the provision of meat. The Lord has provided water. The Sabbath has been instituted. And then, in Exodus chapter 17, after the rebellion at the rock, we have a group of people come up, the Amalekites. And in verse 8, it says that then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. This is that really weird story where Moses has to hold his hands up. If the hands drop, it's not going well for Israel. So they prop his hands up and hold up the staff. We're not going to spend too much time on that part of the story because that's a whole other tangent. But this is that story. This is the battle that's in reference. And so we ultimately see in verse 13 that Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Israel is victorious in this battle. But in verse 14, the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book. It's actually one of the first times we see Moses commanded explicitly what just happened, write it down. This is actually, we're actually seeing the process of how the Bible came together and work in this verse. Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua. So specifically, again, we can kind of, we know who Joshua's going to be. He's going to be the leader of the conquest. He says, recite it to Joshua that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. We see this just real quick repeated in Deuteronomy chapter 25, that Moses does indeed write this down. He does indeed remember it. And in his final speech, before Israel is about to go into the promised land, he reminds Israel and this new generation of exactly what they're supposed to do to the Amalekites. He says in verse 17 of Deuteronomy 25, remember what Amalek did you along the way when you came out from Egypt, how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore, it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from, all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. So Deuteronomy gives us a little bit of context. Amalek does not just attack Israel. This is not two nations who have decided, hey, we're fighting over a piece of territory, let's send our armies. This is a refugee caravan. This is a group of people fleeing from slavery, being delivered by their God to Mount Sinai. And this weary group of people is attacked by essentially bandits. They are attacked by an army seeking to prey on the weak. So Amalek is committing a grave injustice by doing this. Israel has not tried to take their territory. Israel has not sought this fight. Amalek is acting the part of the aggressor. And so the first thing to note is that what God is doing is he's bringing justice against a people who have shown no mercy. And the Lord essentially says to people who have shown no mercy will be shown. Now, again, this might play into the stereotype, like, okay, well, but isn't God supposed to be above such things? Isn't God supposed to be, you know, he tells us to turn the cheek. Why doesn't he turn the cheek? Why doesn't he tell Israel to turn the cheek? Instead, he says essentially, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I thought we were beyond that as Christians. Remember what Israel is serving as in this story. Israel is not just some group of people. Israel is not just one nation among many. Israel is God's chosen tool to not just bring about a covenant relationship with Israel, but to bring about the redemption of the whole world. Israel, as we will see at Mount Sinai, is to rebuild, essentially, Eden in the form of tabernacle. That Israel is to reinvigorate the relationship between God and man. Israel is to be a nation of priests, the mediating presence between God and creation. When Amalek is threatening Israel, they are not just threatening some random group of refugees, which is awful and in of itself worth of justice. But as Deuteronomy says, they do not fear Yahweh. They are opposing God. They are opposing the redemptive plan of humanity. Again, it doesn't happen, obviously, but in a hypothetical situation, if Amalek wins and Amalek wipes Israel off the face of the earth, the whole redemption of mankind is lost. Again, obviously that was never going to happen. But that is the offense that Amalek has given. That is the injustice that Amalek has given. They have declared war not just on a group of refugees. They have declared war upon Yahweh and upon life itself. They have positioned themselves as enemies of God. And so God says, you are to treat them as such then. They are people who are working against the creative plan. And just as God has brought justice against Egypt, he will bring justice against Amalek. Now, all of that backstory is going on in what's happening in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Now, Amalek is a consistent oppressor in the book of Judges. We won't go to all the different verses that talk about this, but throughout the time of Israel in the Promised Land, Amalek is a consistent invader. Now, Amalek is not one of the seven nations that's in the Promised Land. They're not the Hittites or the Amorites or the Hivorites, all those different groups of people. They are outsiders. Clearly, they are from around the area. They're kind of a mobile people. They tend to be a raiding people. So this group of people is not completely destroyed in the book of Exodus. They continue to be a consistent presence and problem for Israel. They are consistent oppressors of Israel. They are consistent enemies. And so we can maybe understand then the context of why Saul is being given the task to fulfill the law. That, hey, Saul, these people, you've been appointed king to provide justice and peace for the land. You are going to go do so by removing the threat of the Amalekites. And so, if we go back over to 1 Samuel 15, we again see this language that is used, and it is language that is uncomfortable to us to hear in a modern context. To go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. That is tough language to read in any context. Israel's supposed to destroy infants? Children? We as a people who, in our culture, one of the biggest fights that we have is over abortion. We might read this and be like, wow, God, infants? Part of what is going on here is there is a specific type of language being used. And this is where it's important to get context and cultural awareness of what's happening. We've talked about this in a couple of other different lessons. That this is intentional hyperbole. And this is language that is used not just here in Samuel. It's not just used elsewhere in the Bible. It's actually used all over the ancient Near East, the culture that this is taking place in. In fact, we actually have records of Moabite king, the stele of a Moabite king, who actually uses this exact same language to talk about Israel. That when he fights against the Omrides, the people of Omri, which is Ahab's father, it's another name for Israel, this stele, it's a historical record, you can actually look up this artifact, and it basically says, I, the king of Moab, by the power of my God, utterly destroyed Israel. I killed every man, woman, child, infant, their camels, their cows, their sheep, no pigs because they don't have pigs, all the different livestock. Everything about Israel was utterly destroyed. Well, we know that didn't literally happen because we have lots of Bible records of things that Israel's very much alive after that. This was the common language that was used, however. And so the Bible, again, writing to a people used to this language, is giving this impression that you are to go win a complete and total victory. This language is less about go and literally commit genocide. I think that's a misreading of this. And it's instead to go take away the power of this people. Make it so that they are no longer a force to be remembered. Now, that does not entirely take away the discomfort of reading about a people who are being instructed to go to war as a people of Christians who are being instructed to be nonviolent. There's still some tension there. And it's okay, I think, to wrestle with that tension. It's okay to dive into that and to work through that and to see that there are differences between what God has asked Israel to do and what God has asked us to do. It's okay to wrestle with those tensions. And again, I think there's answers for that. But there's always going to be that discomfort there. That the Bible is writing to a people that are different than we are. Now again, the Bible's being written so that we might understand the character of God. And I think when we see this particular one against Amalek, what this is showing is that God cares about justice for his people. That God will not allow wickedness to go unpunished. And so Saul is being instructed, go and remove Amalek from power. Make it so that they cannot pursue injustice again. Now, we're not going to read this entire story, but hopefully you're familiar enough with it to remember what occurs. That Saul does, in fact, gain the great victory. Now, listen to what happens here in verse 8 of chapter 15. Saul's defeated the Amalekites. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, oxen, fatlings, lambs, and all that was good, were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. All right, so the picture given to us in 1 Samuel 15 is that Saul kills everybody but Agag, the king, because he's a prisoner and you can parade him around, and isn't it cool that, look, at this king that I captured, I'm so powerful, I'm Saul. Saul fails to do what he's supposed to do. Not only does he fail to kill Agag, he actually preserved basically all the booty, all the wealth, all the treasure that you capture from the enemy. So Saul has failed in his task, but what I want to note here is that 1 Samuel 15 is portraying the Amalekites as utterly defeated. Because then at the end of this, in verse 32, Samuel finishes the job and says, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites, in one of the more gruesome passages. Agag came to him cheerfully, and Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. They're probably over all this. They beat us already. But Samuel said, as your mother has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. That does not make the PG-13 cut of the Bible. So Samuel 15 ends with the Amalekites utterly annihilated. They've had, you know, some of their animals may have survived, but Agag and all the Amalekites, they've been completely destroyed. Except, they're not. If you go over, just 15 chapters later, in 1 Samuel chapter 30, and verse 1, I'll get into the context in just a minute, it says, then it happened, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag, and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. Okay, well, if the Amalekites were utterly destroyed, all the people were destroyed. Agag's dead too. Who are these Amalekites? This happens really consistently in the Bible. That right after you get this language of they were utterly destroyed, man, woman, infant, and child, like a couple of chapters later, you're like, and here come these people again. You're like, wait, I thought you destroyed them already. It's hyperbolic language. Again, that's not given just to blunt the uncomfortableness of this story. This story is still uncomfortable. I think Samuel probably did hew a guy to death. That's a little different than what Jesus has told me to do. There's still a discomfort with that. But when we use terms, and I think this is a mistake to do, when we talk about, well, yeah, God committed genocide. No, God didn't commit genocide. The Israelites didn't commit genocide. I don't think we actually see a single instance, quite honestly, of the Israelites truly destroying a person, an entire people, man, woman, child, and infant. Again, I think that's us imposing a reading onto the text that the text itself actually does not demand. And so that is a partial answer to the question of what's going on. How could God order the total extermination of the people? I think the answer is that he actually didn't, and I don't think that's what's going on in these texts. Now, again, having said that, that doesn't mean that there's not still a difficulty with what's going on and the fact that God is ordering for people to die. I don't think nobody died. God still ordered the Israelites to go attack a people, to go destroy a people, to at least remove them from a source of power. And indeed, David in chapter 30 is being held up as a better king than Saul. Because Saul in chapter 29, 30, and 31, he's actually losing to the Philistines. He's not being a successful king. While he's losing a fight to the Philistines, David is destroying the Amalekites. He's doing what Saul had failed to do. It's actually the author is very intentionally using these parallels to show that where Saul had failed and why Saul was an unworthy king, David was the rightful king. David was a victor over the Amalekites. In fact, in a little bit of dramatic irony, in 2 Samuel chapter 1, again, remember it's all the same story, it says it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, "From where do you come?" He said to him, "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." David said to him, "How did things go? Please tell me." And he said, "These people have fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." So David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" The young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. When he looked behind me, he saw me and called to me. And I said, 'Here I am.' He said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' He said, 'Please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me because my life still lingers in me.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he has fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." You see the dramatic irony? That literally, Saul's failure with the Amalekites results in his death at the hand of an Amalekite. Saul, this whole story is being used to show the unworthiness of Saul as king. Why Saul was ultimately rejected as king. Because David is then going to hear this, and David does not rejoice at the death of Israel's anointed. Instead, he brings justice on the Amalekite. And he has that very Amalekite killed, just after he's beaten the Amalekites in battle in chapter 30. So all of this story is being showcased in this particular context to highlight the differences between the true king and the failed king. Why? What's really cool about this? So the Amalekites are all defeated. But they're not yet. Turn over to the book of Esther. And this is where I want to make the actual point of what I think Amalek has to teach us. So book of Esther, we are jumping forward hundreds of years, way, way, way in the future. And so Esther is in the time of the exile. And so we are introduced to Esther, and we know this is one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. Esther is in the time of the Persian Empire. Esther ends up becoming the queen of Persia, and she ends up saving her and her uncle Mordecai. They end up saving Israel through their faith in God and through their good actions. But there's a really cool sub-story going on here. And it's easy to miss because it's in names, again, these things that we don't tend to pay a ton of attention to. So in Esther chapter 3. We are introduced to the villain of the story. The first two chapters kind of set up Esther becoming queen. And it says, after these events, King Ahasuerus, king of Persia, promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Haman is a descendant of King Agag, the Amalekite. So for an Israelite reader, as soon as you read that, you're like, oh, Haman's definitely the bad guy. He's an Amalekite. He's going to be treacherous. He's going to attack Israel when they're weakest. I know. I mean, it's like every stereotypical trope for an Israelite. The equivalent of this is Hans Gruber showing up in Die Hard, and you're like, he's got a creepy goatee. He's got the European accent. He's clearly the bad guy. Like, we know what a bad guy looks like in our culture. This is what a bad guy looks like in their culture. He's an Amalekite. This guy's bad news. But we've also been introduced to the hero of the story, which which really, if I can make a controversial argument, I'd actually say it's more Mordecai than it is Esther, but they're both heroic. But in chapter 2 and verse 5, it says, there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. And that name might not sound like very much. Okay, he's from Benjaminite. We're told that he's an Israelite. Saul's father is Kish. We're being told not only is Agag's descendant at play here, but Saul's descendant is at play here. This is actually in a very cool, and again, this is all kind of underneath the surface, but an Israelite reader would pick up on this and go like, oh, this is Saul versus Agag again. I've heard this story before. Saul loses in this story. You're actually, you might as an original reader like, oh no, Saul's going to lose. Like, Esther and Mordecai are doomed. Like, Agag gets the best of them. And yet, there's this dramatic reversal. Where despite the fact that God's name is never mentioned in this story, God's hand is at work through all of these events. He has put Esther in this position of power, as Mordecai says, perhaps it is so that you will save your people. And even in the midst of an unfaithful group of people, even in the midst of a group of people that in Esther we pretty consistently see are not super faithful to Yahweh, God is at work to save his people from the Amalekites. And ultimately what we see is that Agag, and not just, Haman, and not just Haman, but his sons are all killed. It is a retelling of the story that God has saved Israel from the threat of the Amalekites. And so what this means is that this overarching story of Israel and Amalek becomes not just this dry piece of history like, oh, just so you know, in AD 4, 7, blah, 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 Amalek got destroyed. But to the people of Israel, the name Amalek becomes a reminder that God protects his people. That God is just and does not forget the wickedness done to the innocent. He will not allow the wicked to go unpunished. It is one of the most predominant themes of the Bible is that God is a warrior for the oppressed. It's in the Exodus story. We see that even after the Exodus, God is protecting his people from Amalekite bandits. We see that God protects his people from themselves in many capacities. But at every stage of the story, in Exodus, in the conquest, in Canaan, in the kingdom, in the exile, all throughout it, God opposes the Amalekites. Not because Israel deserves it. Not because Israel is this great faithful people. In fact, in almost every one of these occasions, Israel has just gotten away with doing stuff really badly. In the Exodus, they've just been rebelling against God. They've been begging for food and water and complaining and everything, and God still saves them against the Amalekites. In Judges, Israel is constantly rejecting God and embracing idolatry, and God still saves them from the Amalekites. Saul is a worthless king who is a rebellious king, and God still saves Israel from the Amalekites. And he brings about the true King David to bring justice. And even in the exile, even when Israel has utterly rejected God, they have rejected the covenant, and they don't even mention God's name, God is still protecting his people from the Amalekites. You see the beauty of Scripture? Do you see the beauty of this story? How all of these stories are being woven into this one story. This one grand story that tells us the God that we serve is good. That the God that we serve is just. He is righteous. He looks out for the oppressed, even when they themselves have brought it upon themselves. This is the God that we serve, and this is why I think it's so beneficial to read these things. This is why I love diving into the text. It's because it's not this dry, old, dusty book of, oh, it's the Old Testament, it's all these history and boring stories and everything. It's telling us who God is. In the midst of all of these names and these stories and these things, there is God. He is good. And that is the biggest thing we can take away from reading these stories, is that God provides justice for his people. So if we want to answer the question, why is this story being included when we're told that God is loving, is that these stories are evidence of how loving God truly is. That God protects his people along every stage of the way. And in fact, we can make a strong argument that Amalek being defeated as they are, is for the betterment of Amalek as well. See, here's where the story gets really surprising. What we just read in Acts chapter 10. Amalek is a Gentile. Amalek is part of the enemies of God that now, through the Spirit, descendants of every enemy of God can become His children. God's grace has not just been given to the sons of Israel, it's been given to the world, that all could be saved, that all who have been enemies of God, all who have rebelled, all who have been the oppressor and the oppressed, can come and become one in Jesus. That is the fundamental story of the Scriptures, is that our just and merciful God has reconciled His enemies to Himself. And it is through the blood and the body of Jesus Christ, the resurrected Savior, the King of Kings, the Son of David, who has defeated not just Amalek, but the forces of darkness behind Amalek, who has won the victory and has protected His people, and will rule forevermore as our true Davidic Messianic King. That is the story of Scripture. And if you've missed that story, you've missed it. And so we come to the conclusion of a lesson that might not seem to be very much about Jesus. And yet what I hope you see is that it's all pointing to Jesus. David is a better king than Saul. But Jesus is the perfect king that David couldn't be. Jesus is the king who does not fail. Jesus is the king who gains victory through submission. Who gains victory over death through death. And it is that King that calls sweetly, "Won't you come to me?" We know the way to come to Jesus. We know the way to submit to His kingship, to be identified with Him, to be saved from our own mistakes and our own sins and the oppressors of this world, to be baptized in the blood of Jesus, and to be raised anew, a resurrected creature. If you have need of that, if you have need of anything that we at West Oaks here can do, won't you let us know while we stand and while we sing?